from Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Skull and Bones, a look at the secret Yale society that unites Democratic frontrunner John Kerry and President Bush. We take a look at the omnibus spending bill, which contains a number of controversial provisions that deal little with the federal budget. From setting new media ownership limits to changing overtime laws to the handling of gun purchases. And Rainforest Action Network declares victory in a five-year campaign against Citibank.
We really see this as a triumph of democracy in the marketplace, resulting in the world's largest bank making significant concessions that are going to have lasting impacts in the rainforest on indigenous communities.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In an interview with USA Today, Howard Dean vowed to return to his centrist roots following his third-place finish in Iowa. He said, quote, "It's who I was for governor for 12 years. I might as well go back to being who I really am." Meanwhile, the New York Times reports Dean is also softening the tone of his speeches and eliminating high-voltage campaign rallies. Tonight, ABC's Primetime will air the first joint televised interview with Dean and his wife, Judith. Also tonight, Dean will join the other Democratic candidates for a nationally televised debate from New Hampshire, which is holding its primary on Tuesday. Two separate polls conducted by the Boston Globe and the Boston Herald are showing Dean's lead in New Hampshire has completely evaporated, and John Kerry is now beating him by 10 percentage points. Computer security specialists have issued a new report strongly criticizing a new Pentagon program to allow overseas voters to vote on the internet in the 2004 presidential election. According to the Washington Post, the report urged the Pentagon to immediately halt plans to launch the program because it's insecure. It could be hacked and undermine the election. Computer scientist Avi Rubin of Johns Hopkins University said, quote, "History has shown that when people have the opportunity to tamper with an election, they do." The Pentagon says it has no plans to stop the program. A group of 40 conservative Republican members of Congress met Wednesday in Washington to strategize how to force the White House to cut government spending. Bush's economic plans have come under increasing criticism from groups that are usually closely tied to the president, including the Heritage Foundation and the Club for Growth, as well as the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. One Republican Senate aide told the New York Times, quote, "The Republican Party has long been the party of small government, but the era of small government has ended for the Republican Party." In a new book, former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill said he warned the administration of a looming fiscal crisis, but was brushed aside by Vice President Dick Cheney, who privately said, quote, "You know, Paul, Reagan proved deficits don't matter." This year's deficit is expected to top $500 billion. In Iraq, a minibus carrying Iraqi women who worked at a U.S. base west of Baghdad came under attack today. Four women died. Another six were injured. Meanwhile, two U.S. soldiers were killed. A third was critically wounded after a U.S. military base in central Iraq was hit by mortar fire. 505 U.S. soldiers have now died since the start of the invasion of Iraq. A Canadian citizen who was detained at a New York airport on a stopover in 2002, then secretly deported to Syria, is filing a lawsuit today against the U.S. government and Attorney General John Ashcroft. The man, Maher Arar, said he was deported to Syria even though the U.S. knew he would likely be tortured there. Arar was jailed in Syria for a year and suffered mental and physical abuse. Meanwhile, in other news related to Arar, in Ottawa, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police yesterday raided the home and office of a Canadian reporter who has covered Arar's case. Police seized notes, computer files, and address books. In November, the reporter, Juliet O'Neill of the Ottawa Citizen, published an article based on information from a secret Canadian intelligence file that she obtained on Arar. She may now face criminal charges for violating Canada's new Security of Information Act, which was passed after 9/11. O'Neill's editor said, quote, "I cannot remember a blacker day for freedom of the press in this country." O'Neill's article claimed Canadian intelligence believed Arar was a member of a disbanded Al-Qaeda support group. Arar has denied any ties to terrorist organizations and has never been charged with a crime. If you'd like to hear an extended interview with Maher Arar, go to our website at democracynow.org. The military defense lawyer who's representing an Australian detainee held at Guantanamo Bay has openly criticized the government's rules regulating military tribunals. Marine Corps Major Michael Morey said, quote, "The military commissions will not provide a full and fair trial. The commission process has been created and controlled by those with a vested interest only in convictions." Morey said tribunal judges will be barred from dismissing charges filed by the Pentagon. He also criticized the appeals process and the message it sends to the international community. Morey warned, quote, "What's to stop the North Koreans from arresting a U.S. contractor as a spy and trying him under the very rules we set up?" You can also go to our website to hear an interview with the father of David Hicks, the prisoner held on Guantanamo Bay from Australia. In Haiti, at least 20,000 people marched Wednesday in Port-au-Prince to show support for embattled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Meanwhile, for the second time in 3 days, police fired tear gas at opponents of Aristide who were trying to hold protests. Since mid-September, there have been almost daily anti-apartheid protests. On Saturday, Aristide said the opposition rallies constitute an attempted coup. And a coalition of anti-government groups known as the Democratic Platform has announced it will refuse to participate in new legislative elections unless Aristide resigns. The coalition, which includes opposition parties, clergy, and business leaders, has called for the formation of a transitional government to govern until new elections can be held. In Israel, Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon vowed that he would not resign, even though an Israeli real estate developer has been charged with trying to bribe Sharon and his son. If charged, Sharon would be forced to step down as prime minister. On Wednesday, the Ohio Senate passed a far-reaching ban on same-sex marriages. The bill defines marriage as a union between a man and a woman and bars unmarried partners of state employees from receiving benefits. The state's governor, Bob Taft, has pledged to sign a gay marriage ban. And in Seattle, the city has agreed to pay $250,000 to a group of over 150 protesters who charged they were illegally arrested during the 1999 World Trade Organization demonstrations. You are listening to and watching Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country. Well, the New Hampshire primary is just a few days away, and Howard Dean's status as a frontrunner has almost totally dissipated. The latest Boston Herald poll now shows that John Kerry holds a 10-point lead, a major surge for the Massachusetts senator. Still reeling from his victory in Iowa, Kerry is starting to act like the frontrunner, shifting his focus from comparing himself to the other Democrats to putting his record up against President George Bush, saying he's the only candidate who can beat Bush and who represents a real difference from the current occupant of the White House.
But there is a fact about Kerry's past that brings him closer to Bush than any other candidate. Both Bush and Kerry are members of a secretive society dating back to their respective days at Yale University. It's called Skull and Bones. This fact has not been widely reported, but when Kerry's campaign spokesperson was asked about it, she said, quote, John Kerry has absolutely nothing to say on that subject. Sorry. In a moment, we'll be joined by Alexandra Robbins, the New York Times bestselling author of Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, the Ivy League, and the Hidden Paths of Power. But first, we turn to an interview I did with Kevin Phillips, the author of American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush, when I asked him about the significance of that Yale secret society, Skull and Bones.
Well, I hate to overdo the secret societies because the average person has no idea of this. And I went to Harvard Law School, and Harvard has these secret societies too, but the ones at Yale, I think, if anything, are more influential, and it's sort of hard to cold turkey right in and say, my God, Skull and Bones, this is virtually like diplomatic or international business piracy, and you can almost see the pirate flag. But they all took it very seriously, because Avril Harriman had, instead of going to Harvard and getting involved in the pork, so to speak, which was the big club up at Harvard, he went to Yale and did Skull and Bones. So a whole crowd of people who were involved in operations like National City Bank and Guarantee Trust and just a whole lot of people who were major players in finance were Skull and Bones. And the crowd that was at W.A. Harriman was full of Skull and Bones people. And Prescott Bush was Skull and Bones. And a lot of these people who were Skull and Bones wound up in the intelligence services, or they were assistant secretaries for aviation in the War Department and things like this. It was a whole network.
But for people who don't know what Skull and Bones is, what you're referring to.
It's a Yale secret society, and Yale has other secret societies. I mean, another one was called Book and Snake, so they came up with these names. But these people took secrecy incredibly seriously. Books that have been written about Skull and Bones, they've got a vault at Yale. You know, nobody's supposed to be able to get in there, and you can't even tell your wife about Skull and Bones. And Avril Harriman, his wife received a letter that was in hieroglyphics, and she didn't know what to make of this. And Avril Harriman said, well, that's Skull and Bones, and I've got to tell you about that. And he said, oh, no, but I can't tell you about that. And if you want to know why they deal in secrecy and all of this, it's because, A, you've got Skull and Bones, and B, so many of them were also in the intelligence services and that whole side of Washington and New York.
Well, can you talk about that, the beginning of intelligence and how the Bush family fits into the beginning of the intelligence agencies?
Well, this gets complicated because nobody quite agrees when the intelligence agencies started. But Yale was front and center because the statue that's in front of the CIA is Nathan Hale. Nathan Hale's statue that they copied that from appears in front of Connecticut Hall and Yale in New Haven. So if you go back to the Revolution, you had Yale and the Secret Service.
And you also, it goes back to Andover, where Bush went as well.
Andover was really in the thick of this sort of stuff. They had a secret society sort of junior grade where you practiced to be a Skull and Bones type at Yale when you were in Andover. And it all sounds like a joke today, but it certainly wasn't back then. And what happened was the crowd that was in with Prescott Bush and George H. Walker at W.A. Harriman, a number of them became prominent in the intelligence community, and then when you get to the firm that was merged out of W.A. Harriman, which was Brown Brothers Harriman, one of the partners there was Robert A. Lovett, who was the son of one of the big cheeses in Harriman's railroad operation, which is how they knew George H. I mean, it all fits together. And Robert A. Lovett was the man who came up with the blueprint for the CIA after World War II, which was never acknowledged and only became public knowledge maybe 15, 20 years ago. So he was a major player. And Prescott Bush, I have no doubt, was very close to the intelligence agencies during World War II. He was a director of two companies. One was Dresser Industries, which is now part of Halliburton, and the second was Vanadium Corporation of America. They were both involved in atomic energy project work. And Prescott Bush was a friend of Alan Dulles, who went on to be the CIA director, but he was also a lawyer during the 30s for some of the Brown Brothers Harriman international gamesmanship, so to speak. So they were very tightly knit into all of this, and the real thing about the Bushes is how far back they go in this loose combination of investment banking, Wall Street law, the intelligence community, international business, the State Department, and the War Department.
That is Kevin Phillips. He is author of the new book, American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. As we turn now to Alexandra Robbins, New York Times bestselling author of the book, Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, the Ivy League, and the Hidden Paths of Power, who is formerly on the Washington, D.C. staff of The New Yorker magazine. She's a 1998 graduate of Yale University and was the first reporter to publish George W. Bush's transcript from Yale when he was a student there. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us, Juan.
Thanks for having me.
Alexandra, I'd like to start out. In your book, you mentioned John Kerry several times. And for those folks who might think that this is something of the college days in the 60s when Kerry was at Yale, but you also mentioned an experience that Jacob Weisberg, the editor of Slate magazine, had about 20 years later in 1986. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Skull and Bones is really much more than just a college club. In fact, the year that the members spend in it, their senior year at Yale, there are 15 members tapped for Skull and Bones membership each year, is really just a beginning. Skull and Bones is a powerful alumni network, perhaps the most elite network in the country, and it really focuses on life after college. What Kerry did was he tried to recruit Jacob Weisberg from his Senate office in Washington to become a member of Skull and Bones. And Weisberg ended up declining the invitation, but he was shocked that Kerry was a member of the society, which so clearly exhibited a history of misogyny, and he challenged Kerry on it, and Kerry sort of blew him off. He said, oh, well, you know, you should look at my record for women defending battered women, et cetera. And Weisberg said, I can't be a part of this. But he was shocked that Kerry would have his secretary call Weisberg into his office in the Senate in order to try and make this recruiting possible.
Could you, though, actually explain that, the fact that he was an intern at the New Republic and he got this call, what this meant to him?
Yeah. He got a call from Senator Kerry's office, from his secretary, and Weisberg was spending the semester away from Yale. He was spending it, his junior year, in Washington. And he got the call, and the secretary said, Senator Kerry would like to meet with you tomorrow morning. And all sorts of things are going through Weisberg's head. He was thinking, oh, maybe he likes my writing. Maybe he's going to give me a scoop. And he said, oh, okay, I'll be there. Do you know what it's about? And the secretary said, no, he wouldn't tell me. So he gets in the next morning, it's about 8:30, I think, and he's sitting in the senator's office, and the senator is sort of schmoozing with him, making small talk, and Weisberg's sitting there wondering why, I guess he was about 20 or 21 by then, why he's sitting in Senator Kerry's office. And then Kerry said, Kerry brought up Skull and Bones. And Weisberg didn't even know Kerry was a member at that point.
And you mentioned the organization's relationship to women. For those of our viewers who don't know about that, could you explain that, the history of that relationship?
Oh, sure. Skull and Bones has been an all-male group, was an all-male group, beginning in 1832 when it started. up until 1991. And what happened was there was basically a 20-year fight between the younger members of Skull and Bones and the older, more staunch old blue members. In 1991, the seniors in Bones, these are the 22-year-olds who were actually in the tomb that year at Yale. The tomb is the name of their building, by the way. In 1991, the Bones seniors intended to tap women, but the alumni of the society heard about the plan, changed the locks of the tomb, and threatened to shut down the society completely. When the seniors threatened a lawsuit, Bones held a vote that narrowly endorsed admitting women. But the day before initiation, a group of Bonesmen led by William F. Buckley obtained a court order blocking the initiation. The group claimed that admitting women would lead to, and I'm quoting here, date rape in the medium-term future. Eventually, Bones held a second vote that again narrowly admitted women. Both Bushes have refused to disclose which way they voted. Senator Kerry and former Senator David Boren both said that they voted to admit women. But once the women were initiated, several of the older members, including a former congressman whom I spoke with, distanced themselves from the society.
What about George Bush on this issue? Have we ever found out how he voted on this defining moment in the
Both Bushes have not disclosed which way they voted. Mm-hmm.
Although Bush was quoted as saying, and this was George Herbert Walker Bush, is that right, saying that women would be the downfall of Yale?
That's George W. Bush.
George W.
George W. Bush said in the 1980s to a woman who was a graduate of Yale that women would be the downfall of Yale. And there are many other instances, some of which I point out in my book, that lead one to assume that he voted against admitting women.
We just heard Kevin Phillips give us a kind of chronology of people who are in Skull and Bones and its significance in the U.S. establishment, for example, in the founding of the Central Intelligence Agency with Robert Lovett. Can you talk more about this for those who would say, come on, as Juan was saying before, you're talking about some college club?
Yeah, I actually want to back way up and talk about, at least just mention exactly what Skull and Bones is, because while some people on the East Coast have heard about the society, other people across the country, you know, had no idea that we're looking right now, if the polls are correct, at what would be the first Skull and Bones versus Skull and Bones presidential election, which is pretty weird. Skull and Bones is America's most powerful secret society. It's based at Yale, where it's headquartered in a building called the Tomb, and Skull and Bones has included among its members presidents, including President George W. Bush and his father, as well as William Howard Taft, Supreme Court chief justices, CIA officials, cabinet members, congressmen, and senators. What makes it so staggering that we could have a Skull and Bones versus Skull and Bones, Kerry versus Bush election is that this is a tiny, tiny club. There are maybe only 800 living members at any one time, only 15 per year. So it's kind of staggering that two of them suddenly could be facing off for the presidency, and so many of them have achieved positions of prominence. One of the interesting and I think disturbing things about Skull and Bones is that its purpose is to get members into positions of power and then to have those members hire other members into prestigious positions. This is something we have seen with George W. Bush. Since his ascendancy to the presidency, he's put several Bonesmen in prestigious positions, such as Bill Donaldson to head the Securities and Exchange Commission, the number two or number three guy in the Justice Department, the guy who, coincidentally or not, puts out all of Bush's secrecy memos. He's an assistant attorney general, and he's a major Bonesman. Bonesman Frederick Smith was reportedly Bush's top choice for Secretary of Defense until he had to withdraw for health reasons. The General Counsel of the Office of Homeland Security, the Secretary of Defense's representative to Europe, the list goes on and on and on. And that's something that's interesting because George W. Bush likes to feign his distance from Yale, from Bones, from Northeastern establishment elite connections, and yet he's going ahead and following Skull and Bones to the letter.
And besides seeking to employ or promote Bonesmen, are there any other responsibility that Bonesmen are supposed to have to each other?
Well, there's loyalty, of course, to each other. They're supposed to call each other up, and I revealed the code words they use in my book, so I assume they've probably since changed them, but it used to be, do you know General Russell? And General Russell was the founder of Skull and Bones, and all a Bonesman had to do was call up another Bonesman, maybe even if they'd never even met before, and they would cough up money or connections or a plan.
We have to break for 60 seconds, but Alexandra, if you could stay with us just for a few more minutes,
sure.
Want to find out the that very special number that many Bonesmen use, maybe even John Kerry, and also about your own membership in a secret society in Yale.
Okay.
Stay with us.
If you want something to play with, go and find yourself a toy. Baby, my time is too expensive, and I'm not your little girl.
Tell It Like It Is, Etta James, here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Alexandra Robbins. Her book is Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, The Ivy League, and The Hidden Paths of Power. Alexandra Robbins, the number.
That would be 322.
And explain the significance of that.
Okay, so according to Skull and Bones lore, and this is something that both Senator Kerry and President Bush would have learned, in 322 BC, the Greek orator Demosthenes died. When he died, the goddess Eulogia, bear with me here, I didn't make this up myself, the goddess Eulogia, whom Skull and Bones calls the goddess of eloquence, arose to the heavens and didn't happen to come back down again until 1832, when she just happened to take up residence in the tomb of Skull and Bones. Now Skull and Bones does everything in deference to this goddess. They have songs, or they call them sacred anthems, that they sing about Eulogia when they are encouraged to go out and steal things, some remarkably valuable items, supposedly. They are said to be bringing back gifts to the goddess. They begin each session in the tomb, and they meet twice weekly by unveiling a sort of a gilt shrine to Eulogia, and that's basically the point of the society. They call themselves the Knights of Eulogia. So that's where the number 322 comes in.
And John Kerry, in terms of the number 322?
Actually, I spoke with somebody who's very close to Kerry, who was also a member of Skull and Bones, and he said that Kerry actually uses 322 as a code in his daily life.
You talk about how some people use it as the extension of their phone,
right,
and other examples. Well, Alexandra Robbins, you too are a member of a secret society at Yale. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. Well, I was a member. Ever since Secrets of the Tomb came out, I can't get members of my own society to talk to me. So I believe that means I'm out, which is okay because I only joined it for the free alcohol in the first place. Anyway, the society is called Scroll and Key. It's the second oldest society at Yale. It was actually helpful for me to tell the Bonesmen whom I interviewed. I interviewed more than 100. That I was a member of Scroll and Key, because they just assumed that since it has a similarly prestigious roster, although no presidents, that I would be able to put their information in context and that I would align with them and their views towards secret societies, which, of course, I didn't. I don't believe that these kinds of secret societies have a place in this country or in this world unless they have some value to the community. And Skull and Bones stands out as, I believe, the one Yale secret society that doesn't do anything for the community or for any other entity other than itself.
Why was John Kerry recruited?
It's a good question. I could go look up his Skull and Bones bio, but they basically choose people whom they believe will reflect honor and prestige back on the society. They're basically trying to figure out, okay, who's the who's who here of the Yale junior class, who's going to be the most successful. One other thing interesting about Kerry that I wanted to mention is that both of his wives have been directly related to members of Skull and Bones, a sister and a daughter, which is another connection to Skull and Bones that people don't usually know about.
Alexandra Robbins, our guest, Secrets of the Tomb is her book. What about the induction ritual?
That's a weird one. It's sort of a cross between a Harry Potter novel and a haunted house. The heart of the initiation is a ceremony that takes place in Skull and Bones' most sacred room, which now we know is probably called, well, you'd think it probably is. I can tell you it definitely is, called Room 322. It's also called the Inner Temple. And I did get a hold of the script for initiation, so I lay that out in my book. But to give you a little teaser, there is somebody dressed as the devil, somebody dressed as Don Quixote, somebody dressed as a pope who has one foot sheathed in a monogrammed white slipper that rests on a stone skull, and the other knights are dressed up as skeletons, and the alumni or patriarchs sort of line the halls and are supposed to make as much noise as possible. In part of that ceremony, the neophytes must kiss the pope's foot, drink quote-unquote blood from the Yorick, which is a skull container, and the initiation ends when the initiate is shoved to his knees in front of Don Quixote as the sort of shrieking crowd falls silent, and Quixote taps the junior on the left shoulder with a sword and says, "By order of our order, I dub thee Knight of Eulogia."
And let me ask you, one of the first articles you wrote about the Skull and Bones elicited an unexpected response and a threat to you as well. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I was surprised, because when I wrote that first article for the Atlantic Monthly, I basically dismissed Bones as a somewhat harmless organization because my own secret society didn't have that power agenda, so I didn't think Bones did either. However, after the article came out, I got a call at my office at the New Yorker from a journalist whom I knew by name to be a member of Skull and Bones, and he scolded me for writing the article. He said, and I'm quoting, "Writing that article was not an ethical or honorable way to make a decent living in journalism." Then he asked me how much I had been paid for the story. I, of course, refused to tell him, and he hung up on me. 15 minutes later, he calls back, and he says, "I've just gotten off the phone with our people." And I laughed. I knew he meant other Bonesmen, but I laughed because I didn't think somebody would actually say our people. And he told me this: the society demanded to know where I got my information. I wouldn't tell him, of course. And then he spent the next 15 minutes or so berating me for writing about Skull and Bones, for having the gall to expose something about his secret society. And he ended the conversation by saying, "There are a lot of us at newspapers and at political journalism institutions across the country. Good luck with your career." And he slammed down the phone. I was 23 then. I was an aspiring investigative reporter, so that did shake me a little bit. But what really appalled me was that I found out since that in the years since that call, this guy has been actively going out and trying to destroy my career as a journalist simply because I wrote about Skull and Bones.
Well, would you like to let us know who he is?
Wish I could. Don't want to give him any fodder.
It's interesting. At the beginning of the segment, we quoted Kerry's campaign spokesperson, and she's quoted in the Boston Globe saying, "John Kerry has absolutely nothing to say on that subject. Sorry." Now, we're used to politicians, you know, declining to speak about something.
Right.
That's no problem. But it sort of gives new meaning to new meaning behind what she is saying.
Yeah, if this turns out to be a Skull and Bones versus Skull and Bones election, I guarantee people across the country are going to clamor for more information on this secret society. And I think that's the point of my book, and probably the point of your program too, which is that I don't think that the elected officials who represent our country, especially the president, should be allowed to have an allegiance to any secret group, because secrecy overshadows democracy. We need a certain transparency in our government so we can hold elected officials accountable for their actions. And also, I don't think it's a coincidence that what I would call the most secretive government in America today's, since the Nixon era, is run by a member of the world's most infamous secret society. And that's something we want to avoid in the future.
Also, you mentioned that, or the caller mentioned, that there were many journalists who were members of Skull and Bones. It would be interesting to perhaps to keep track of the journalists who are and how they're covering the current presidential race and analyze their coverage of both Kerry and Bush.
There are a slew who are members of Skull and Bones, and some of them are biased, some of them aren't. Dana Milbank of the Washington Post is certainly not a biased journalist. He doesn't hold allegiance to his Skull and Bones connections, which is nice. And there are some others who also follow their profession more than the society. But you will get people in Skull and Bones who favor Skull and Bonesmen. That's sort of the point of the group.
Who are the other reporters who are Skull and Bonesmen?
Oh, there's a whole list of them going back to Henry Luce and Britton Haddon, who were the founders of Time magazine. Actually, both Time and Newsweek have Skull and Bones origins, which is kind of strange.
Who else?
Oh, I could give you the list, but I think I'll hold off.
Okay.
When it comes to, you know, who are Skull and Bonesmen and who covers this issue, what kind of coverage has the John Kerry connection to Skull and Bones gotten? George W. Bush and George Bush Sr., that has been covered somewhat.
Oh, little to none. And when people have tried to ask him about it, he clams up. I heard this secondhand. I didn't actually watch the show myself, so I don't know how reliably to take this. But somebody told me that Kerry was asked by Tim Russert on Meet the Press directly about Skull and Bones. And according to the person who saw this, he said Kerry looked like he was about to pass out, wouldn't say a word. People don't think much about Kerry and Bones, I think partly because for George W. Bush, his Skull and Bones connections sort of work with the whole theory that he's riding his father's coattails and that he has gotten his way in life because of his connections, which I would agree with and which I've traced in Secrets of the Tomb to align closely with his Skull and Bones connections. He turned to Skull and Bones throughout his career for help. Even his Rangers deal, which is supposed to be the one thing he achieved on his own, had at least one Bonesman involved. Kerry, on the other hand, has not relied on Skull and Bones. He hasn't made it a huge part of his life in terms of something that would boost his career or really propel him, although he has turned to Skull and Bones in his personal life. But Kerry's been just as involved as Bush, I think, although he'll be as quick to deny that as the president will.
Does it matter to Skull and Bones who wins this presidential race?
No. It's a good question and one that I asked many Bonesmen, and the way they describe it is a win-win situation. As long as there's a Bonesman in the White House, there are going to be many more Bonesmen in the administration.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Alexandra Robbins has been our guest. Her book is Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, the Ivy League, and the Hidden Paths of Power. Alexandra Robbins, a member of another Yale secret society, or at least she was, and also wrote for the New Yorker magazine, among other publications. As we move now to another issue, important topic of the day.
Well, Democratic senators have delayed the passage of the $373 billion omnibus spending bill Tuesday, in part because it contains a number of controversial items that deal with the federal budget. The bill, which was approved by the House in December, imposes policy items ranging from setting new media ownership limits to the handling of gun purchase records. Although the vote is a setback for Bush and leaders of the Republican-controlled Senate, it is clearly just a temporary one. The Washington Post reports that Democrats probably lacked the votes to stall the bill much longer. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle said the bill would pass in the next few days, regardless of whether that issue and others were dealt with.
Today, we will take a look at three of the policy items included in the bill. The first is a provision that would allow the Bush administration to rewrite the nation's overtime laws. Unions say the plan could strip up to 8 million workers of overtime pay. The Labor Department is publicly claiming that just under 650,000 white-collar workers would be affected. Labor Secretary Elaine Chao says the current rules are outdated and confusing, and employers are being subjected to $2 billion in, quote, needless litigation annually because companies and their workers do not clearly understand their obligations and rights. Chao said the proposal would guarantee overtime pay protections for 1.3 million low-wage workers who make under $22,000 a year. The Associated Press recently reported the Labor Department itself
listed several ways employers could avoid paying overtime to those low-wage workers. Mark Wilson is on the line with us now, Washington, D.C.-based attorney who specializes in overtime issues. He works for the Communications Workers of America and the International Union of Police Associations, former government prosecutor with the National Labor Relations Board, and is the chair of the D.C. Bar Committee on Labor and Health Standards. Juan?
Well, Mark Wilson, I mean, there's a huge gap, obviously, between what the administration is saying the number of workers will be affected and other independent labor analysts are saying. What's the crux of the difference between them?
Well, there's actually not a great deal of difference between what the Department of Labor's documents say and what the EPI study said. The problem is that the people that are speaking on behalf of DOL are saying something entirely different from what their documents say. The Department of Labor's documentation on the proposed rules estimates that at least 3 million employees would be more easily classified as exempt under the new rules, and they also admit that that number does not count people who are currently getting overtime pay. They derive that number simply by looking at the number of people who are being denied overtime pay illegally and then sue and win. And they're saying that by changing the rules, they're trying essentially to wipe out those litigation claims of the employees because those litigations are costing employers back pay money. So if you count not just the people who are being denied overtime pay, but also the people who are getting overtime pay right now, and also people who are allowed to receive overtime pay but don't actually work overtime hours, then the DOL number actually is just about the same as the EPI number, which is between $7 and $8 million. Now, I think both of those numbers are actually relatively low.
That's 7 and 8 million people, you mean?
Right? That's right. 7 or 8 million people would be losing overtime protection under both of the EPI and DOL numbers. I think the number is actually quite a bit higher. The EPI study only looked at about a third of the workforce. And if you can figure that if you look at only a third, you come up with 8 million employees that will be impacted. You can see that if you count the rest of the workers as well, the number is likely to be much higher. The numbers will actually wipe out, the rule changes will actually wipe out overtime rights for probably more than half of the office workers in the country. And this is not just white-collar people, but also blue-collar workers, technicians, and lots of other blue-collar workers. And the regulations say that specifically. They specifically identify firefighters, police, nurses, truck drivers, all kinds of workers who would lose overtime rights if these regulations go through.
Mark Wilson, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. We'll be back with you. And the issue of overtime pay, is it near to being wiped out by new legislation in a minute? Happiness is a warm gun, the Beatles, and we're going to have a debate on the provision in the omnibus bill dealing with guns in a minute. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. This is Democracy Now! As we wrap up our discussion on overtime pay We are talking to Mark Wilson, Washington, D.C.-based attorney who specializes in overtime issues. Juan?
Well, Mark, a lot of workers who are in, not in unions but are office workers in America would say, what overtime? Because the reality is that for decades now, the dominance of so-called comp pay over overtime in many office work facility areas has increased, and the workers, many of them are afraid to actually challenge the law, to file a complaint, because they'll have trouble keeping their jobs.
Well, that's a very important concern. You should understand that there is a great deal of cheating going on by employers with regard to overtime rights. The Department of Labor estimates that at least 8 million employees are being denied overtime pay illegally each year. And a lot of those employees are suing in court and winning their overtime pay. These rules are designed expressly by the Department of Labor to wipe out that possibility because employers are saying it's just too costly. So when Secretary Chao stated the other day that there's $2 billion annually in needless litigation costs, what she really meant and what the documentation says is that the $2 billion per year is money that employees are getting back in overtime pay. Only overtime pay. This is not attorney's fees or any kind of frivolous litigation cost. This is actual back pay that employees are winning in court because the employers didn't pay them. Well, Elaine Chao says that that's just not fair to businesses, and so these rules are being written specifically to eliminate those overtime claims.
And is there any way that this can be changed at this point?
Well, there was a Harkin Amendment that was attempting to stop the rule changes that was attached to the omnibus bill originally. It was voted on by the Senate and by the House. A majority in both groups voted in favor of this stop measure. And then the White House put a great deal of pressure on the Senate and the House to strip that back out. That's why there's now a filibuster on the omnibus, because it does not contain that Harkin Amendment any longer. So there's a prospect for stopping this through some standalone legislation, but because the keys to that are in the hands of Republicans who are very in favor of these rule changes, I'm not so sure what the prospects are for actually doing something in Congress to stop the Department of Labor. It would seem to me that the Department of Labor itself would need to reconsider this, and certainly the White House would need to look at this with a critical eye towards helping workers more than helping businesses.
Mark Wilson, we want to thank you very much for being with us. D.C.-based lawyer specializing in overtime issues, works for the Communication Workers of America and the International Union of Police Associations. As we move now to another part of the omnibus spending bill, which requires federal officials to destroy background check approval records on gun purchases within 24 hours of the purchase. The current law requires the records to be kept for 90 days.
Opponents of the measure say it would take a much harder, it would make it harder to track guns used in crimes, investigate shady gun dealers, or even track down someone plotting a terror attack who might buy guns in the United States.
Backers say record destruction will not hamper law enforcement, but will protect gun owners' privacy. At a December 2001 hearing, Attorney General John Ashcroft declared FBI checks of gun records into foreigners being detained on suspicion of possible connections to the September 11th hijackers would, quote, violate their privacy.
Law enforcement groups across the country oppose the gun purchase measure. Los Angeles Police Commissioner William Bratton said, quote, I just don't understand how Congress can even consider it. Obviously, they haven't shown up at the scene of enough officer shootings.
We are joined by Eric Howard, spokesperson for the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, and Andrew Arulanandam. He is director of public affairs for the National Rifle Association, backing the amendment. Let's start with Andrew Arulanandam. Why do you like it?
Well, I think there need to be several clarifications. First of all, the universe of records that are in question over here are the approvals. Hence, they are the records of law-abiding Americans. The National Rifle Association has no problem with law enforcement maintaining the records of those disapprovals, hence those criminals, for as long as law enforcement needs them. Again, these are records of law-abiding Americans, and they should be destroyed according to the law, which you erroneously stated stipulates that it should be kept for 90 days. The law states that this is the national instant check system with an emphasis on instant. The law intended for all records of law-abiding Americans to be destroyed as soon as the approval came through. This 90-day stipulation is just a hangover from the Clinton administration.
Eric Howard, your response?
That's not true, actually. The NRA tried filing a lawsuit and lost on the argument he's making right now, that is not the case for holding it for 90 days.
What lawsuit are you referring to?
I'm talking about the one that you brought up originally, when the records were kept for much longer than they are right now, and you lost on that.
But if you look at the law under the National Instant Check System, which is part of the Brady Bill, which you should be very familiar with.
Right, and there's nothing in there about an instant check.
Way back when you were known as Handgun Control Inc., which since the name that you've since dropped.
I'd like to clarify a few points here. First of all,
let me just reintroduce you, Eric Howard, spokesperson for the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, and Andrew Aralanandam's spokesperson for the National Rifle Association. Eric Howard.
Thank you. First of all, it isn't us pointing out that this is a serious problem and will allow hundreds of criminals, felons, and stalkers to keep their guns. It is the independent investigative arm of Congress that investigated this after Ashcroft originally made the proposal, and they determined that within 6 months, hundreds of individuals who are prohibited purchasers will be armed, and this is only one provision that is in this omnibus bill. There are three others that really concern us, and it's part of the gun industry and the gun lobby's defense against a story that they are really unhappy that is being told, and it's being told by partly by Robert Ricker, who was a former NRA lobbyist, a top gun industry lobbyist. And the story that he told when he testified in court is that the industry is knowingly funneling weapons into the illegal market.
In response to that, AB, I would like to say that Eric is completely off the mark. Either he does not know the law or he's intentionally trying to deceive your listeners, because the law states under the National Instant Check System, which was signed into law by none other than President Clinton, that records of law-abiding citizens should be destroyed instantly. And again, I can't emphasize this enough. The universe of records that are in question over here are the approvals. These are the records of law-abiding Americans. And I don't know how else to say this. The NRA has no problems with law enforcement maintaining the records of disapprovals or criminals for as long as they need. So I guess I'm at a loss as to why Eric continues to push this propaganda, and his organization as well continues to push this propaganda of deceit. To be perfectly honest, I think this is a desperation tactic. They have failed
Let me ask Eric Howard a second. Why would the need for more than 24 hours? Is it that the 24-hour time would not allow sufficient time to catch anybody whose background should not allow them to hold a gun permit?
There actually are a couple of reasons the GAO cited. One of them is that after an individual is charged, it takes time for the case that they cited, which happens quite often, is a domestic violence abuser is charged, but the information isn't in the system yet, and the individual goes buys a gun, and it doesn't get flagged. He succeeds in buying his gun because the system hasn't made it up yet to the federal level. And then often these individuals, seeing that they were able to succeed the first time, go back a second time. But during that second time they go for the sale, the system it's now in the system and it flags them.
Well, we have to wrap up this discussion. I want to thank you both for being there. National Rifle Association spokesperson, as well as a spokesperson for the Brady Center, to people couldn't have more opposed views, Eric Howard and Andrew Aralanandam. Michael Moore points out in one of his letters and in his book, John Ashcroft is still prohibiting the FBI from looking through the gun background check files to see if any of the 19
19 hijackers or their associates purchase any weapons prior to 9/11, because that, he said, we are told, would violate these terrorists' sacred Second Amendment rights. I don't think most people in this country understand that. By the way, Michael Moore will be joining us tomorrow on Democracy Now! And if people have questions for him, you can email them to us at mail@democracynow.org, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Or you can call and record a message at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. As we turn now to another measure in the omnibus bill, and that has to do with the FCC. The second provision of the bill we take a look at, third one, is one that eases limits on the number of television stations a company can own. We only have a minute. We're joined by Jeff Chester, Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy. Jeff, can you explain what that is very briefly?
This provision is a big Bush administration and GOP giveaway to two of the most powerful media companies and political allies. In the case of Rupert Murdoch, it allows ViacomCBS and Murdoch's News Corp Fox to hold the number of stations they presently own. They would have been forced to sell if this provision hadn't been worked out in a backroom deal by the White House. And it's not surprising that early this week, CBS refused to sell an ad to MoveOn.org in the Super Bowl that was going to be critical of the Bush administration, that the Bush FCC a few weeks ago allowed Rupert Murdoch to become even more politically powerful here in the United States by taking control of the U.S.'s most powerful satellite service, DirecTV. So huge giveaways to these two big media giants, and a blow in terms of media ownership and democracy.
And Jeff, any chance of amending that portion of the bill out, or is it look at this point that there's not much hope?
I think we have to hold 5 feet to the fire of the Democrats and to any kind of well-meaning Republicans here. I mean, you know, Senator Kerry's taken a lot of money from the media companies. His brother works with a big lobbying firm that represents cable and wireless companies. A lot of the other Democratic candidates are frankly silent on this issue. We have to rebuild a lot of energy if we're going to make this a key issue and put some new limits back in.
Jeff Chester, Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy, thanks for being with us as we wrap up today with the Rainforest Action Network. Later today, the group is announcing it's ending its grassroots campaign against the world's largest bank, Citigroup. The bank has agreed to adopt a series of new environmental policies dealing with indigenous populations. Here to talk about this issue is Elise Hogue, Director of the Rainforest Action Network's campaign for a sane economy. When you were last with us, you were certainly going after Citibank. What happened?
Well, about 8 months ago, Citigroup came to us and said that they were concerned about their brand reputation suffering as a result of the grassroots activities around the world. I want to stress this was not just a U.S. campaign. We were joined by partners in Peru and Ecuador and Indonesia. And I think that the results that we're seeing in the announcement today are going to benefit our allies around the world as well as people at home. It is the most significant environmental policy to come out of the private financial sector to date. And it's going to put in place no-go zones, ecological areas that are so critical they're off limits to investment, as well as make the very first statement ever out of the private financial sector on climate change. And as we see private finance investment in developing countries increasing and dwarfing public finance, there was not even the basic standards that you see in the World Bank or the IMF, as well as we know that those aren't enough. So what Citigroup did today was not only acknowledge that, but surpass the public finance standards and set a new bar for the investment sector. So we're going to need to look at the rest of the investment sectors, from Chase Manhattan to John Hancock Insurance, who are sinking more and more money into the most egregious fossil fuel developments around the world, and hold them to what we now see as the best practices in the industry.
And do the other groups around the world who have been participating in a campaign against Citigroup agree with this, or is this Rainforest Action Network itself?
We did extensive consultation, and we had quite a long time to write the policy with Citigroup, and what we did was extensive consultation with the groups that we had worked with. And I think we're going to see that while everyone acknowledges it's not enough to confront the magnitude of the problems that we're placing, it is the most significant step to date that we've seen from a private bank.
We only have 30 seconds, but while you're announcing the end of the campaign against Citigroup, you are issuing a new list of 10 Wall Street institutions that have weak environmental policies. Who are they?
No environmental policies, Amy. JPMorgan Chase, who just got the reconstruction contract in Iraq, by the way. Bank One, Bank of America, Fleet Boston Financial, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, John Hancock, Wachovia, U.S. Bank Corp, and SunTrust.
Well, we will go into that on another day. We thank you for being with us, Elise Hoge of the Rainforest Action Network, announcing the end of their campaign against the world's largest bank, Citigroup. That does it for the show. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo, Rich Gim, and Johnny Sender are our engineers. Thanks also to Uri Gallet, Angela Alston, Orlando Richards, Simba Russo, Karen Renucci, Dennis Moynihan, Jenny Filippazzo, Isis Phillips. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, Michael Moore tomorrow on Democracy Now!